We knew the economy was going to turn at some point, but you never really can be prepared for timing or speed of change.
I hope this cycle we're in doesn't take us back to the days of regulatory purgatory, where everything we did had consequences.
As the world continues to change, we have found out we need to be even more nimble as we move forward.
By requiring things like business continuity planning and pandemic plans, we need to think proactively about what we need to do in the future.
We better grab our helmets and start getting prepared today.
Banking is a risk business, but in today's environment, we are being faced with uncertain times. Financial institutions have always had partners who could help evaluate, address, and mitigate risk, but today they need to lean on those partners more than ever. Welcome to Bank on Whitfleet. Each episode will feature discussions around industry issues, hot topics, and current trends, giving you an insider's look at how top performers and professionals are staying ahead of the curve. All right, let's get into today's conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bank on Whitfleet. My name is Mike Vessel, and I'm a partner in our financial services practice and the host of Bank on Whitfleet. A lot of things have changed over the last year in this era of COVID, but there's some things that don't change. We'll talk about one of those today, that being financial fraud. I've been reading that opportunists have been taking advantage of the changes organizations have had due to work from home, rotation of people, branch closures, utilization of technology, you name it, resulting in an overall increase in the rate of fraud. I actually saw two statistics this morning. Phishing attacks have increased almost 700% in 2020, and ransomware has increased about the same. Those are external examples, and there's certainly examples of internal frauds as well. So to discuss the increase in fraud that we have today, we have with us Mark Curry. Mark is a director who leads the forensic area at Whitfleet. Mark has 25 years of experience in forensic investigations, fraud risk assessments, internal investigations, information and governance issue, including risk management, business ethics, and employment practices. In addition, he often works with organizations on proactive fraud risk mitigation. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me here today.
Well, glad to have you. So Mark, we've been in the throes of a new work and life environment for over a year now. Tell us what you've been seeing in that time frame related to fraud risk and whether there's any trends you've noted, or, you know, both internal and external.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. There definitely have been some changes, not just in the way businesses work, but also in the way fraudsters work. And we are seeing that now as a result of those external pressures on organizations, as well as a result of what the organizations have done internally in response to that. And we've seen an uptick start now, although I think that uptick is going to continue to grow. You know, we're at the beginning of the wave. We're not at the crest of the wave yet. And this is similar to what we saw back in 2008, 9, and 10 during the recession as well, where we saw an increase in the amount of fraud that was perpetrated both inside organizations and outside organizations as well. So, you know, what we're seeing right now from an external perspective, you know, you've mentioned the phishing and the ransomware. And, you know, for financial institutions, from an external perspective, that is the biggest issue. What we've probably seen the biggest uptick in has been the phishing attempts or some other type of an attempt where email accounts get taken over. And that can be both within the organization or outside the organization. And then that email account that's been compromised is used to perpetrate a fraud. So it can be, you know, email gets taken over at one of your customers or one of your vendors. The fraudster then uses the actual organization's email, sends an email in, changes routing information or payment, you know, routing information, and you wind up sending it somewhere else. Those kind of things happen. Similarly, we've seen, you know, internal emails get taken over and for similar types of schemes. We've seen them, you know, be used for perpetrate other frauds, you know, as a home base to send out malicious emails. And then we've also seen where the email gets harvested, where they look at what information is retained in email and use that, try to, you know, identify PII, you know, customer information, that kind of information that's just sitting there in the email. So we've seen, that's the biggest increase in risk that we've seen outside the organization. And then within the organization, We've seen internal frauds, again, resulting from how the organization has reacted to COVID. So as you mentioned, the push to, you know, work from home, branch closures, downsizing, you know, the reduction in staff means changes are occurring to internal processes and internal controls. That leads to a couple of things. Number one, you've got the pressure on employees, and they may be facing this, you know, pressure from, you know, spouses or other family members that have had their jobs and income to the family reduced. So that puts pressure on your staff. And then the changes within the internal organization function, have you thought about or considered how the changes to what you do and do it on a day-to-day basis, how that's impacted your internal controls, and have your internal controls kept up with that? And again, what we tend to see is that that lags, and sometimes that lag time can be really significant to maybe even a never, where it never gets considered. And, you know, the organization is just kind of operating on autopilot, and that opens up a lot of holes within the internal control structure.
So Mark, is fraud cyclical? You know, are we just seeing fraud when events like COVID happen, or do you see other cycles as it relates to fraudulent events?
Well, definitely there's some parts or some types of frauds are cyclical, and then other types, frankly, aren't cyclical. And so, and the cyclical can be tied to, again, kind of two big areas, the external factors that are outside your control and the internal factors that you have more control over. So as I just mentioned, you know, the external factors, the change in the environment, the pressure that your employees and their families face, you know, those kind of things, that can, definitely does have an impact, and you see fraud uptick in that environment. Things internally that you can control also can lead to these cyclical changes. You change what you do, you downsize, that can put additional pressure on employees and the ability for them to rationalize bad behavior. So that internally, those kinds of internal changes can affect it. Also, you know, things that are not in response to external factors, but that happen cyclically within organizations. So that can be annual cycles, you know, tied to busy season kinds of things, or, you know, you roll out a new product, or you have an acquisition, or you implement a new IT system or a new core system. You know, those kinds of things can all bring opportunities for people to do the wrong thing. And then you've got the non-cyclical fraud where you just, frankly, there's always this kind of underlying current of people that are under stress, are tipped over to doing the wrong thing and take advantage of their employer, and then they navigate to the dark side and do the wrong thing for their employer.
Mark, you mentioned a couple of the types of fraud that you're seeing. Are there some common fraud schemes, some other fraud schemes, or maybe some examples that you've run into recently that you can share with us?
Sure. You know, those schemes I mentioned before were kind of the external schemes. From an internal perspective, you know, the reality is you name it and you've seen it. And, you know, just when I think I've seen it all, we'll see something else happen. But there are some that we tend to see, you know, that are kind of the low-hanging fruit from a fraudster perspective. And so, and they tend to be grouped, classified into two types of fraud in terms of the risk to the organization. One is the risk of people who are in the accounting or the finance area and kind of, you know, work with the cash and the organizational assets on a day-to-day basis. And then you've got the rest of the organization. And so for the rest of the organization, the schemes that we tend to see would be things centered around expense reports, expense reimbursements, credit cards or company P cards, and those frequently go in tandem too. So you might see somebody that's both running expenses through on their expense report, getting reimbursed, and then 2 or 3 months later submitting, you know, also charging the cost on the company credit card or P card. So the company's paying for it on the credit card P card, and then 2 months later, the same receipt's coming through on an expense reimbursement that they're getting, that the employee's getting reimbursed for. You also see non-cash be targeted. So again, in areas, not that we would ever see an IT director go bad, but we've actually seen this occur with a couple of our financial services clients where the IT director, you know, is targeting high value equipment, you know, right? It can be computers, it can be components, you know, large screen monitors or, you know, TVs, and then they're taking it home and using it in their you know, home side IT consulting business. Another risk that we see kind of related to that is we'll also see IT directors take home used equipment that's being decommissioned by the organization and use that in their side IT business, reselling it and putting it back out into customers. And a big risk there, frequently there's not a lot of value in used equipment, but the biggest issue is, has the data been wiped? And, you know, is your customer information been properly wiped from that? Or is that now floating around on those old systems? And then in the accounting or the finance area, you know, what we usually see are people who have the authority, you know, might be fictitious vendor schemes. If it's somebody that's involved in invoice processing and maybe vendor, you know, vendor setup, if you, again, if you don't have segregation of duties, it might be easy for them to set up a fictitious vendor or change a vendor that you used 4 years ago, you know, change the address or the routing information and slightly change the name, and then start processing invoices for fictitious invoices, or just frankly getting cash out. Once they figure out a way to get the cash out, if they've got the ability to post general journal transactions, we'll see them using general journal transactions to conceal their identity. And along those lines, we'll also see people that are, you know, using dollars, the money's coming out of customer accounts. You know, that's one area. The other area, frankly, where there's a lot bigger risk, particularly for large dollar misappropriations to occur, is in the trust area, where customer trust accounts are getting hit for inappropriate expenditures by a trust officer.
So Mark, you just threw out a lot of things there. What percentage of organizations do you think have some sort of fraud going on within them?
99.7%. Well, 100% have fraud. And then there's some small percentage that believes that their employees would never do that to them. And that's, you know, that's all kinds of fraud. So that's everything from people that are taking Post-it note packs and things like that home, using the, you know, printing for their personal, you know, needs or their, you know, whatever, all the way up to the large frauds. But the reality is the fraud that hurts, you know, and in my world, things that we see are $4,000, $8,000 a month, and the fraud goes on for 6, 7, 8, maybe more years. And so you start talking about real money. You know, these are things that are not quickly identified and go on for long periods of time. You know, those add up to real money really quickly. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on out there.
So if I'm in an organization and I think that there's some fraud, I suspect some fraud someplace, what are the steps that I should take?
Sure. And I'll break this up into kind of two steps. One is, if you're just a team member or, you know, you're a staff member, you're not part of management that's reacting, responding to the fraud, but you think you know something's going on, biggest thing is report it. You know, make sure the organization knows about it. You know, if you've got an anonymous reporting mechanism, use that. If you don't, you know, go to somebody that you, you know, in management that you have confidence is not involved in what you think is going on, and report it. That's the biggest issue. And statistically, tips, particularly tips from employees, are the biggest way in which frauds get discovered or identified by the organization. If you're part of the organization's management that's responsible to responding to those tips or allegations of wrongdoing, you know, the couple of things. Number one is, have a plan or think about it before you actually have an incident, because when you actually have something you're dealing with, it can get really easy to be emotional and forget about kind of all the things that need to occur. And hopefully you haven't had to deal with this before, so you don't have a lot of experience dealing with, you know, wrongdoing. But it's making sure that you know what to do, when to do it, you know, get the right people involved, you know, get legal counsel involved early on in the process. Make sure that, you know, you have the right professionals helping you. You know, do you have the staff internally with the training and tools to do the investigation? Is it even a good idea to have your internal folks, you know, investigate part of the organization, or should that be, you know, handled by somebody outside the organization that's independent and objective? You know, what information might exist? You know, nowadays there's more and more information that's relevant in digital formats. So are you, you know, collecting the right kinds of digital information? Are you preventing stuff from being deleted? We've had people that have rolled shredding machines into their offices and shredded paper for a couple of days. You know, have a lot of employees that, you know, the digital equivalent is they hit the delete key for days on hand too. So are you doing the right things to help preserve and protect the evidence that you need to actually conduct a good investigation?
One of the things that you didn't mention there, and I think those are all good points, is insurance and insurance companies. And my experience is that those typically get involved. Most organizations have some level of fraud coverage. Do you have any tips for organizations related to the insurance piece, what they should be doing as far as notification and so on and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, the most important thing is make sure you have insurance and make sure that you've got adequate coverage. I will say in our experience, usually financial institutions are better about that than other types of organizations just because of their nature. Although I did have one case in particular where we had a CFO at a small one location, it was actually a thrift, that nailed them for $4,970,000 and they only had $3 million of employee theft coverage. But absolutely, make sure you've got insurance. Make sure you know what your coverages are, what your requirements are to notify the insurer. Most of those policies, you have to at least notify them of a potential claim within a certain amount of time, or it raises an ability for them to say, oh, you're not covered. Make sure you know that. Also make sure you know, particularly on both employee theft and cyber insurance that covers some of those phishing and ransomware that we mentioned before, make sure that you understand what the insurer is requiring of you to do from using experts. Sometimes those policies, the insurers will require that you use experts from their panel. They'll either require it, or they'll prefer it, or they'll be silent and they'll let you pick your own. If you have to use one somebody from their panel, you've paid for the insurance. And I have this discussion with clients all the time. You've paid for the insurance. You might as well take advantage of it. And in a lot of cases, those policies are not going to just specify, you know, forensic experts. They're going to say, okay, here's our panel of law firms that will help you from a legal perspective. They'll have communications people to help you craft the appropriate communications for your customers and employees and all your constituencies. They'll have financial forensic experts. They'll have digital forensic experts. That might be part of your policy. And again, just make sure you know that you check that early so that you understand what is expected of you.
Mark, I assume there's some best practices around fraud prevention. Can you comment on what some of those would be?
Sure, definitely. I think the number one best practice is to recognize that fraud happens and it will happen to you. It's not an if. And it's not that your employees would never do that to you. You know, again, we frequently hear that our staff would never do that to us, or when we're doing an investigation, well, the rest of our staff wouldn't do that to us. But it's number one, recognizing that you're at risk for this happening. And then what do you do in light of that? And so the second thing in light of that is figure out what your risk is, right? Do a risk assessment. And that can be everything from, you know, a really detailed process by process analysis to a more targeted high level risk assessment of, gee, what could go wrong? You know, you can even ask your employees, again, going back to employees, knowing what works and doesn't work within an organization, they know, you know, gee, if you were gonna do something to take advantage of us, what would you do? A lot of them know what they could do and what they could do and get by with. But doing that type of risk assessment, that can be, you know, a fraud risk assessment that really focuses around the fraud risk to the organization, or it can be a targeted internal control assessment with an emphasis on internal controls to address that fraud risk as well. But those are kind of foundational things that the organization can do. And then everything that comes on after that is, you know, putting the right, you know, controls, the appropriate controls in place, and making sure that those controls are operating effectively.
And I assume that in making sure that they're operating effectively is some sort of an internal audit function type engagement or something like that, whether you do it internally or get outside help, correct?
It definitely it is. It's a more holistic internal audit. You know, frequently when we're working with internal auditors and financial institutions, they tend to be really focused on the compliance issues that financial service organizations face. But when you look at internal audit in a more holistic approach, it's, you know, looking at taking a particular process, understanding how that process, what is that process involved from cradle to grave, and looking at how it works, the controls that are built into it, and analyzing, you know, are they, number one, are they designed well, and adequately? And number two, how are they actually operating? Because it's not unusual. In fact, it's probably more appropriate wording is it's frequently we run into a situation where an organization might think they have controls and they're designed pretty well, but how they're actually operating on a day-to-day basis can be significantly different, opening up significant risk that they didn't realize was there.
Yeah, I think we see that, and especially in this era where people are working from home or, you know, branches are closed, you've got different processes and so on. There were actually two stories in the Journal of Accountancy this month around fraud. And one of the things that I noted in reading the articles was that the authors recommended that employers be aware of their employees or associates and what's going on in their lives. And I've heard personally from clients over the years that they trust their employees explicitly and don't feel the need to do anything extra to monitor, you know, for fraud because of that. So at the same time, I think a lot of those fraud events in hindsight would have been identifiable if either the right questions were asked or if somebody would have raised the alarm. So what's the right answer? Do you suggest that employers make sure they understand what their employees are doing? How do you do that considering privacy issues that, you know, surrounding personal lives of employees and associates?
Well, you know, again, this points out kind of those external factors that can influence or affect the organization's internal risk. And what we're really talking about here is, you know, your staff, you know, they're human and they face those pressures. And so, you know, some people in the audience today might have heard, you know, might be familiar with the fraud triangle, where you talk about, you know, the opportunity, the rationalization, and the need. And, you know, that need and the ability for people to rationalize is what we're really talking about here. And so, again, given the external circumstances, you know, the strain that staff are under, yeah, if you've got an employee that you know is going through an issue, right, what happens if the employee, you know, I can come up with scenarios where a lot of people might even say, you know, figure out a way that wouldn't normally be inclined to take advantage of their employer would, you know, what if you've got a child that has some sort of, you know, uncurable or highly, you know, very expensive to cure disease or condition, and, you know, insurance coverage doesn't cover it, and what would they do to solve that? So again, it's just recognizing that pressure that families of your employees can be under, right? They might have had, a member might have lost a job, had their hours reduced, that can put additional pressure on employees. In the literature, what you tend to see are four big items from pressure points. Those would be gambling, general lifestyle, unreimbursed medical or uninsured medical expenses, and addiction issues. And in doing this for now more years than I'd like to think about, but in doing this for, you know, close to 20 years, I've only seen gambling and lifestyle. I've never seen unreimbursed medical expenses, and I've never seen a chemical addiction. It's always been those other needs that the employee just can't meet, you know, through their legitimate income that drive employees to do these, you know, to go over to the dark side and now take advantage of their employer. So to the extent you know about that, to the extent you offer, you know, employee assistance programs, those kind of things, just recognize that that's frequently one of the pressure tipping points that, again, can cause good employees to go bad.
So, Mark, can you give us some examples of successful fraud programs that you've seen or been involved with?
Sure. And this is where it gets a little bit challenging, because it's not like we're going to recommend, oh, here's the 1 to 39 steps. A successful fraud program for an organization or for two similar organizations can look quite different because of these differences, minor differences or differences within the organization, and even look different because of the organization's own approach to risk management. But they share some common themes. You know, one is, again, a recognition that fraud happens and that it's likely going to happen to you. It's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. Number two is the organization proactively managing its risk. You know, so that's, again, that's understanding where your fraud risk is. It's understanding, you know, what your control environment looks like, you know, doing things like fraud risk assessments, internal control assessments. Those are proactive. It's not in response to a fraud incident, but it's being proactive. Look at and manage those risks. And then again, having a sound control environment afterwards and making sure that you're monitoring, are your controls actually operating the way you think you designed them? Because the best fraud risk assessment, internal control assessment, and the best design plans don't do you any good if people aren't following them. So it's kind of that holistic approach that makes an organization have a successful fraud risk management strategy.
Yeah, I probably should have said successful fraud prevention program. We're not here to tell people how to instigate a fraud. So
the how to commit it and get away with it, that's a different podcast.
I think it is. So Mark, we have a lot of financial services organizations, financial institutions that listen to our podcast. And this is a time when a lot of those organizations are looking at future profitability. There's a lot of stresses and strains on that. And sometimes these programs cost money. If there was only one thing an organization could do to manage its fraud risk, what would that be?
Well, I hope what you really meant is that, is there only one thing that they could do better? Because hopefully they've got a whole bunch of other things going on. Again, there's not a single bullet. If there was one thing, you know, if they don't have anything from a fraud risk perspective, then it is, you know, put a fraud risk strategy in place. That's the biggest thing, is to have a strategy. But if we're talking about a particular type of control activity, or, you know, whether it's preventive, detective, you know, et cetera, the number one recommendation I would make that we frequently see organizations not utilize to the extent they could would be to have better management reviews. I usually refer to them as meaningful management reviews, because again, you need to operate, you know, profitably. You know, profitability is a concern. Finances are a concern these days. And so it's not like you can just add staff to get better segregation of duties. And the reality is segregation of duties isn't going to solve it for you, because if it did, you'd never have fraud in large organizations with large staffs. There's one item that we would say organizations could make better use of that would help them profitably, economically, and even from an efficiency perspective, manage their fraud risk. It would be to have meaningful management review. And unfortunately, a lot of time we see management review that's being done, but it's not meaningful because it's just kind of given cursory, or not, you know, people don't really understand what is the risk that they're trying to prevent or deter or detect, and therefore what parts of that management review do they really need to think about. It's not, oh yeah, these asset accounts were reconciled. It's, the question is, did you look at the whatever the adjustments were or the reconciling entries? Do they make sense? Gee, if one account has a reconciling item for $57,000 this month, and a different account has a reconciling item for $65,000 next month, are you sure that they're not the same and the same person's reconciling the accounts? You know, could they be, you know, using a plug figure, moving it from account to account, and it increases from month to month because, gee, that's how much they made off with, they misappropriated during the month. So it's really having a little bit more in-depth review to those management reviews to make them be meaningful.
I think that's a great point, Mark. And we used to have a partner here who is now retired, who one of his favorite sayings was, everybody looks at what the boss looks at. And that's certainly true in this area and very important. Speaking of which, how do I educate my board and senior management team about that fraud prevention? How do I let them know what their roles should be, what they should be asking, what they should be doing above and beyond what you just mentioned for that meaningful management review?
Sure. I think if you're working with your board and you feel like the board doesn't appreciate that, I think then you have to do a little bit of education. You know, it's helping the board understand, you know, what's happening in your industry. It's kind of like looking in the trade rags and saying, oh, gee, what's everybody else got going on? And it's not just a, gee, I'm glad I'm not them, and that will never happen here. But it's, you know, recognizing, you know, what the organizations are facing. Additionally, for this environment, because of the regulatory environment that they, you know, people operate in, it's helping them understand what are the regulators? What questions are they asking? What are they emphasizing or looking at as well? And, you know, this is one area where sometimes the message maybe doesn't have as much impact when it comes from somebody within the organization or as it does from somebody outside the organization. So maybe part of that education is to get somebody else, again, with a little bit of independence and objectivity, to come in and help educate the board about what the risks are, what are the expectations. You know, what are the regulators, what are your, you know, customers, your shareholders, you know, your constituency, what do they expect you to be doing? Because, you know, what you don't want to have happen is say, oh, gee, this happened. And then people start asking, well, how did this happen in the first place? Why did it happen? And what are you doing to recover from it and to manage or mitigate your risk going forward? And the answer, you know, not to have good answers for that as what the organization has done. So I think that education component becomes really critical.
I think that's a great point as well. You know, you talk about the risks, and somebody at the board level may say, gee, we're insured, so why are we spending much time on this? But certainly the regulatory risk, reputational risk, those are also things that are critical and can hurt your organization if something like this is out there, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And in this day and age, if you're the victim organization and you've had somebody do the wrong thing, you've got the direct loss from whatever they took, and hopefully you've got insurance, because generally fraudsters can't repay, you know, the things I listed that they're spending money on. You know, they're not investing their ill-gotten gains in, you know, stocks and bonds. So you need the insurance to recover from. But absolutely, you know, the question becomes, how are we going to get back to it? You know, how are we going to prevent this from happening again in the future, et cetera?
So why do fraud prevention programs fail? Is there a reason or a barrier to those being successful?
Yes. The number one reason is because people, you know, don't believe this is going to happen to them, that their staff are not going to do it. And a component or kind of a follow-on to that is, unfortunately, that organizations rely on trust as a control, and trust is not an internal control. I understand that organizations have trust in their employees, that they hire people that they believe they can trust, but trust in and of itself isn't a control activity. And in particular, what we generally see is we see people that are in positions of trust may in fact be people who are part of the control environment, right? It could be an individual who's executing one or more of those management reviews that we talk about. And if they go bad, what are your other controls that are in place to help identify that? Or should a person that's doing management reviews really be able to make their own entries, you know, enter transactions, you know, to either customer accounts or to internal accounts and post those? Is that really a very good practice? It is if you trust your employees. But again, trust is not a control. And when that employee goes bad, that's where the control environment just completely breaks down, falls apart. So again, I think that's the biggest issue that we see, is that reliance on trust sets up an opportunity for the organization to have a failure when it's disappointed in that it couldn't trust its employee.
Well, Mark, this has been really enlightening and certainly appreciated. Are there any key takeaways you want to leave us with as we wrap up?
I think the key takeaway is to recognize that fraud risk management and fraud risk prevention and detection, it's an ongoing process. You know, again, it's kind of alluded to it earlier, right? Changes in the business organization, changes in what you've made an acquisition, you've added new products, you're doing things a little bit different. You know, this is not a one and done. This is an ongoing process to evaluate, recognize, consider, you know, what the organization is doing today, how that might have changed, have your controls kept up, have operations, how they actually function, kept up as well. So this is part of a holistic, recurring approach to managing the risk.
Well, great. Well, Mark, thanks a lot. We appreciate your being with us today. And we're glad that all our listeners could join us as well for this topic. If anybody has questions or would like more information on this topic, you can contact either your relationship executive, or you can go out to our website at wifley.com for Mark's contact information, as well as other industry-related items and thought leadership papers and so on. Until next time, this has been a Bank on Wifley podcast.
You've been listening to Bank on Wifley. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and tune into the next episode as we feature insights from other leaders in the financial industry and even more ways you can stay ahead of the curve.